the same people we are officially told being recruited and trained by Zarqawi's al-Qaeda network in Iraq. Now, according to a Pakistani military analyst familiar with these proxy operations, he said these US-made arms were not being supplied to the Iraqi government because we needed to conceal the role of US assistance. They said the destination was clearly US arms would not be given to the Shiite security forces because it would basically give the game away. What's actually happening is the US is playing a double game to head off the threat of a Shiite clergy-driven religious movement. So you've got the United States backing the Shiite regime to this day in Iraq, while at the same time arming elements of the former Ba'ath Party, purportedly, who are teaming up with Al-Qaeda's Zarqawi in Iraq. Is it any wonder that a number of observers are now starting to suspect that there may well be a strategy of tension in Iraq? God forbid, it's not a conspiracy theory, I'm a lunatic. We now know that this covert policy was indeed intensified by 2006, and we have Seymour Hersh, the Pulitzer Prize-winning American journalist, to give the credits, who's now confirmed that this strategy is being accelerated across the Middle East, but focusing on Iraq, Lebanon, and Iran. On CNN last year, he summarized his latest exclusive, which was published in New Yorker magazine. And this is what he said. He said, the Bush administration is actively sponsoring Al-Qaeda-affiliated groups across the entire Middle East with a focus on Lebanon to counter regional Shiite Iranian influence. Moreover, much of the finances for these operations were being funneled by Saudi Arabia through Iraq. And just, I'll give a couple of quotes to give you a gist of what he's saying. He said, we are interested in recreating what is happening in Iraq, in Lebanon, that is Sunni versus Shia. We've been pumping money, a great deal of money, without congressional authority, no oversight. Prince Bandar of Saudi Arabia is putting up some of this money. He's also been linked to 9/11, by the way. For covert operations in many areas of the Middle East where we think that we want to stop the Shiite spread or the Shiite influence. And he says, this money has gotten into the hands, among other places, but in Lebanon, at least three Sunni jihadist groups, whose main claim to fame inside Lebanon is that they're very tough. These people are connected to Al-Qaeda. And he continues, he says, my government, which arrests Al-Qaeda every place it can find them, is sitting back, while the Lebanese government we support is providing arms and sustenance to three jihadist groups. So America, my country, without telling Congress, using funds not appropriated, I don't know where, by my sources, who believe much of the money obviously came from Iraq, all kinds of loose money that could be used for covert operations, they're running covert operations, using money not authorized by Congress, supporting groups that are involved with the same people that did 9/11, and we should be arresting these people rather than looking the other way. Hersh was very angry about this. He couldn't make sense of it. And he's been writing about this stuff for a while. And this is deja vu. You know, the same unholy triangle, not rolled up at all. The US at the helm, Saudi Arabia proxy, providing the funds, Pakistan providing military intelligence support, Gulf states in the background, but this time not in Afghanistan, primarily in Iraq and thereby throughout the Middle East. It seems that Al-Qaeda is still a useful mercenary outfit for our covert regional geostrategy. Pretty clear. I mean, this is something that is difficult to avoid, that conclusion. Now, in March 2007, so this is only a couple of months ago, only about a month or two before the recent terror incidents in London, in Glasgow, again, he reconfirmed this conclusion writing in New Yorker. And I'm going to quote from him again in detail. He said, White House insiders are calling this policy the redirection. But if you look at the history I've discussed, it's not a redirection. It's an acceleration of an existing policy. And he said, it's designed to bring the U.S. into an open confrontation with Iran to propel it into a wider sectarian conflict between Shiite and Sunni Muslims. A byproduct of these activities has been the bolstering of extremist groups that espouse a militant vision of Islam that are hostile to America and sympathetic to Al-Qaeda. They have been kept secret, in some cases, by leaving the execution or the funding to the Saudis. Now think about that. You've got people like Ed Hussein. Do you remember Ed Hussein, who wrote the book The Islamist? It's an interesting book. I mean, I think the guy's gone through a genuine process. The guy, he says he was a former jihadi. He's gone through a process. Now he's kind of said, he's realized that what he was doing was wrong, and he's kind of written a refutation. And his refutation goes a little bit too far. You know, if you associate any kind of political mobilization and is an Islamic overtone, then you're an extremist. So he goes way too far. And he paints, you know, he does the same thing the Americans and the British government do, same mistake, painting everybody with the same brush. One of the things he talks about is the Saudis. He's always going about, you know, the Saudis. The Saudis are funding the mosques in this country. They're radicalizing us. And I was saying, yeah, you know, the Saudis are a problem, you know. But I was like, you know, if there's radicalization going on, it's not happening at the mosques. I mean, let's accept the profiles of the guys who have been prosecuted. And there are questions about those prosecutions and the methods involved and so on and so forth. But let's accept that. These guys weren't radicalized at mosques. They didn't go to mosques. So there is a Saudi connection. But what is the Saudi connection? The Saudi connection is the Americans have given them a direct order that you are going to funnel the funds for covert operations in the Middle East to target Iran. There's going to be a civilian fallout, but hey, that's not the problem. And there's a very revealing quote that Seymour Hersh puts there that puts it all into perspective. And he quotes a US government consultant who told me that Bandar and other Saudis, here's Seymour Hersh writing, Bandar and other Saudis have assured the White House that, quote, they will keep a very close eye on the religious fundamentalists. Their message to us was, we've created this movement and we can control it. Very confident after 9/11. You know, were you controlling it then? What was going on then? It's not that we don't want the Salafis to throw bombs. It's who they throw them at. Hezbollah, Muqtada al-Sadr, Iran, and the Syrians, you know, perhaps odd casualty at home. If they continue to work with Hezbollah and Iran, that's fine. So I repeat, we've created this movement, we can control it. It's not that we don't want the Salafis to throw bombs, it's who they throw them at. That is an incriminating statement under criminal law. It doesn't matter what theory you hold to, it doesn't matter what alternative theory or mainstream theory you believe in about 9/11 or 7/7, whatever. That is complicity under criminal law, that you're financing a terrorist group knowing they are going to carry out attacks, knowing that part of their remit is to bomb your own citizens. There's a term, there's a legal term, it's willful and reckless indifference. You could sue those and hopefully someone will. Just on that ground alone. I was going to continue quoting Seymour Hersh. I love this guy. He's done some really good stuff, but I think I've overdone Seymour Hersh. So now we know Al-Qaeda Salafis will throw bombs. And apart from trying to blow up American, British, and other civilians, if we continue to funnel them arms, funds, and logistical assistance, perhaps this would allow us to control them sufficiently to make life difficult for the Iranians, perhaps even provoke them into a response that will legitimize an Anglo-American strike at them, to use the words that Seymour Hersh quotes from an American official. So this analysis brings up to a number of concluding points. Now, I know I've gone on for a long time here. From 1979 until 2007, and I want to emphasize that I've not brought up evidence that is kooky, that is, you know, some technical disputes going on here. This is just mainstream historical, sociological evidence that can be cross-checked, cross-referenced. From 1979 until 2007, this network, amorphous network, designated by the term Al-Qaeda, has functioned seamlessly as a mercenary proxy force mobilized in diverse strategic regions in the service of Anglo-American imperial expansionism. It hasn't ever had a break. The extent of it is absolutely shocking, and I want to emphasize that because I haven't discussed what's been happening in the Asia-Pacific. I haven't discussed what's been happening in Chechnya, in the Caucasus. I haven't discussed what's been happening in Algeria, where you have Al-Qaeda terrorist groups financed with American money. And, you know, this is mainstream evidence of, again, a strategy of tension in these regions. Mountains of evidence in the public record showing this. essentially Western state sponsorship, indirectly and directly, of Al-Qaeda as a destabilizing force in strategic regions. Meanwhile, innocent citizens are being killed. They were being killed since 1993. You know, we have endless numbers of these attacks. Yet the policy has not shifted. On the contrary, it's now escalating in the context of developing an even more catastrophic conflict with Iran. This has damning moral implications. It means that at some level, policymakers are morally indifferent to the deaths of our own citizens in Al-Qaeda terrorist attacks. Other strategic imperatives, such as the control of increasingly scarce energy resources, are more important. There has been a shift of priorities. Something in the national security structure since 1979 has relegated civilian life way at the bottom. So obviously, I don't think we need more anti-terror laws, nor do we need, as an immediate solution, as the conventional left will ask, just pull out of Iraq and Afghanistan. Is that the only solution that you guys can offer? I mean, that's a pretty bankrupt solution. You know, this is a whole history of a whole structure here. Because there's more. I'll continue. Is pulling out of Iraq and Afghanistan alone, and just, you know, is this going to solve this particular structure that we've had since 1979? We need to do more than that. We need to have some kind of way of holding our governments to account for a policy that has gone on for more than a decade. Policies which have systematically created Islamist terrorism worldwide. Iraq and Afghanistan, and God forbid Iran in the future, and the other interventions that have been going on before then, these are all facets of this wider process. Indeed, they are crucially important, but we need to factor them into the big picture and understand why we are in Iraq, why we are in Afghanistan, why we are continually financing terrorists across the globe.
And I've taken the liberty of trimming the last 4 minutes of Nafees Ahmed, slightly exasperated and struggling to come to terms with the magnitude of what he's uncovering, systematic campaign of false flag terrorism. And I found the following article from 2006 to provide a larger context. This is by Brian Bogart, but it does draw heavily on Nafees Ahmed's work, so it's not quite as independent as I would have liked. But as with Nafees, Brian Bogart is clearly a scholar of the first order and provides a very helpful analysis of his own, putting it in context as the same people, the same institutions, the same ideas, the same sort of rabid paranoia which fired the Cold War, leading pretty smoothly and directly into the so-called global war on terror. And towards the end of the piece, he's highlighting the importance of the 1979 Jerusalem Conference on International Terror. And I shall probably conclude the reading next week. There wasn't time this week, but if you'd like to read the whole document, I've posted it on Wikispooks, and we'll link it in from this show's webpage, unwelcomeguests.net/714. Sins of Statecraft. The War on Terror Exposed. Theories on Militarism and Prospects for Transformation. By Brian Bogart, published on the 29th of July 2006 on Information Clearinghouse. Few things are more crucial to our global situation today than a comprehensive understanding of the fundamental habits and recent overtly aggressive trend present in United States foreign policy. To achieve such requires a look into the long-standing tradition of creating external threats to conceal unsavory imperial operations conducted elsewhere in the world. This paper includes an examination of the US-USSR Cold War and the so-called War on Terror as covers for expansion of imperialism and 9/11 in the context of provoked and internally engineered first strikes throughout American history, devoting much of its contents to theories on militarism and post-World War II influence on policy making. How and why those in power do what they do. The reasons for the use of the long-standing instruments of fear and militarism in the cause of navigating the contours and undulations of the Cold War are revealed in the context of the post-Cold War War on Terror, which employs the same rhetoric and means of manipulation. Such revelations are not limited to identical methods, but spring forth from statements voiced by the manipulators themselves. A recent example, among many, came from the wife of Norman Podhoretz, Midge Dechter, founder of the Committee for the Free World, and co-founder of a plethora of single-minded think tanks, ranging from the second incarnation of the Committee on the Present Danger, Hudson Institute and Heritage Foundation Coalition for a Democratic Majority, to the Project for the New American Century, PNAC. In a 2004 Los Angeles interview, Dechter stated,
"We're not in the Middle East to bring sweetness and light to the world. We're there to get something we and our friends in Europe depend on, namely oil."
Statements like these surface after years, even decades, of manipulations that use very different and far more publicly palatable rhetoric to arrive at the tipping point when pretext to get what manipulators want are achieved and exploited. Regarding methods, again reflecting undulations in tensions between presidents and individuals acting in groups to influence policy, groups whose objectives invariably have little or nothing to do with democracy and the welfare of the American people, a clear pattern of self-serving interests emerges from the comparison of the ascendancy of 32 CPD members, that's the Committee on the Present Danger, to posts in the pro-Cold War Reagan administration, with the ascendancy of a roughly similar number of PNAC members to posts in the pro-War on Terror Bush administration. Though the precise reasons have somewhat varied between the end of World War II and today, they have in common the convergent interests of such influential groups with like-minded groups outside the U.S., who together stood to gain from imperial ambitions pursued under the cloak of American projection of force as a response to the well-fashioned threats of communist enslavement and international terrorism, respectively. All of this is, and has been, about control of Central Asia and counteracting or inhibiting Russian and Chinese moves to control its resources. As Zbigniew Brzezinski observes,
"For America, the chief geopolitical prize is Eurasia. Eurasia is the globe's largest continent and is geopolitically axial. That puts a premium on maneuver and manipulation in order to prevent the emergence of a hostile coalition that could eventually seek to challenge America's primacy."
Importantly, he adds,
"Moreover, as America becomes an increasingly multicultural society, it may find it more difficult to fashion a consensus on foreign policy issues, except in the circumstance of a truly massive and widely perceived direct external threat."
A statement that should be understood in the context of one made earlier in his book.
"The public supported America's engagement in World War II largely because of the shock effect of the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor."
Daniel Yergin identified two axioms of Soviet intentions that led up to the creation and eventual adoption in 1950 of the most important foreign policy document of the last 56 years, NSC 68, the Riga axiom of belligerency, a militarized version of George Kennan's early hostile viewpoints while stationed in Riga and Moscow before and during World War II, and the Yalta axiom, based on the greater understanding achieved at the Yalta conference with regard to post-war visions that would employ cooperation, compromise, and face-to-face diplomacy. While in 1945 great strides were being made under the Yalta axiom in Moscow meetings with Joseph Stalin, at home the Yalta axiom was under attack from an inner circle of State Department officials who recognized an economic opportunity in the vacuum left by the fall of the Third Reich and the exhaustion of old European powers. Notably, many in this inner circle that would later trumpet the adoption of NSC 68, had worked together in Wall Street investment firms, served in high military positions, or were otherwise intimately connected to the corporate web from which they stood to reap massive profits in a heightened military state. These State Department officials, projecting the Riga axiom, insisted that Russia was an aggressive, totalitarian power bent on world conquest, contradicting Central Intelligence Agency assessments. Thus, between 1946 and late 1950, the Yalta axiom came to be rejected by a confused and pliant President Truman, setting in motion a lucrative tragedy and an escalating trend that continues to this day. 2 points illustrated by Jerry Sanders' book, Peddlers of Crisis, are useful in understanding manipulation. Firstly, NSC 68, while presented as a military strategy in response to an imminent threat, was in reality an economic strategy requiring military build-up to suggest that a threat existed. Secondly, the Committee for the Present Danger, CPD, was formed by supporters of NSC 68 to manipulate the public and Congress into embracing NSC 68's recommendations. NSC 68 itself, drafted in January 1950 and signed by Truman in April 1950, was not enough to persuade, nor was the advent of the Korean War in June 1950. Only after CPD was formed and issued a series of media statements, followed by echoing statements from President Truman in December 1950, did the public and Congress perceive a threat grave enough to motivate the adoption of NSC 68's recommendations for, quote, a threefold increase in military spending on nuclear and conventional forces, a bold program of rearmament, unquote. In April 1950, when NSC 68 was signed, 4 months after Truman had approved the hydrogen bomb program, the US possessed some 500 atomic weapons and was producing them at a rate of 4 per week, while the Soviets had only recently tested their first atomic bomb and possessed at most a dozen such weapons. This perception, or deception, highlights the thesis of this study, that the US majority acquiesces to an aggressive arrogance arising whenever the three spheres of financial, military, and political powers fall into the hands of an elite, self-serving minority that is highly influential through media, lobbying, one-on-one persuasion, and key connections within these spheres. As NSC 68 reveals in its own language, and as revealed in the statements of its supporters, the notion of an external threat, in this case the Soviet Union, was required to maintain US-European trade advantages gained from World War II. The illusion of a Soviet threat in Europe was key to preventing European trade partners from ratifying the prevailing desire among Soviets and Europeans alike for a neutralist trade environment, while the external threat in the US was necessary to persuade the public and Congress into acceptance of NSC 68's huge defense budget increases, ostensibly to provide protection, but in reality to legitimize the threat and produce economic growth both in the US and Europe, whereas growth in Europe meant more growth in the US. In other words, the threat was not as real as NSC 68's economic goals. But only the threat could achieve those goals, and only through exaggeration. NSC 68 was therefore an offensive strategy disguised as a defense against communist enslavement. The resulting new foreign policy of what Sanders calls containment militarism, adopted by Truman and which should not be confused with the conventional notion generated from the term containment policy, consisted of a structure that grew and prevails today, requiring new external threats to maintain today's U.S. global trade advantages, mainly produced in the intervening years, and previously, through imperial coercion. Thus, the degree of deceit necessary to sway public opinion also grew, often employing first strikes against Western assets, both to satisfy this demand for acceptance and acquiescence, and to serve as pretexts for the placement of forces in geostrategic regions and approval of finances necessary to sustain key areas of the structure. Today, this geostrategy is directly linked to the predicted peak in world oil production, since lucrative control of renewable resources is much more difficult to concentrate in the hands of a few. Western nations have chosen to maintain their immediate investments and establish supremacy over remaining energy reserves by supporting U.S. foreign policy, though they have little choice but to acquiesce and follow U.S. policy because of the strength of its military. In any event, the exaggeration of threats in the war on communism have given way to more virulent preemptive and preventative policies in the war on terror that represent a trend far more devastating to American founding principles and produce a danger to the global security on a scale not seen since the Cuban Missile Crisis. Between 1798 and 2004, the United States conducted 322 operations involving U.S. forces abroad, not counting covert operations, disaster relief, and routine alliance stationing and training exercises. 153 of these occurred between 1946 and 2004, and have dramatically increased in frequency decade by decade. This astounding number represents the most prolific global projection of power by any empire in history. Even worse, no nation in modern times has worked so hard to kill independence movements, and the U.S. has routinely done so in the name of freedom and democracy. In The Rise and Fall of the Soviet Threat, published in 1979, Alan Wolfe states that, quote, without a sharply negative view of an enemy, it is difficult to justify an activist foreign policy. He rightly suggested that, quote, post-war American policy has gone through two peaks, two valleys, and now seems to be entering a third peak, unquote, with a peak being a U.S. assertion of strength against Soviet ideology, represented by an increased defense budget, or interventions and symbolic displays such as moving the American fleet. For the first peak, Wolfe pointed to the period from the end of World War II to the early 1950s, particularly the decision to build the hydrogen bomb and the issuance of NSC 68, the blueprint for every belligerent strategy report issued by the Pentagon under the Bush administration, and similar documents drafted by Paul Wolfowitz and PNAC prior to the ascendancy of George W. Bush to the presidency. The second peak began in 1957 with the Gaither Report and culminated in the Cuban Missile Crisis. The third peak began in 1976 with the Team B Report, authorized by the then CIA Director George Bush Sr., the resulting push for intelligence community reform, and the reappearance of the CPD, which flooded the media with false notions of an impending Soviet first strike. Paul Nitzer was instrumental in all three peaks as primary author of each of these three belligerent documents. It could be argued that a third valley arrived with the collapse of the Soviet Union, so sudden as to deflate and disappoint such staunch neoconservatives as Irving Kristol and Norman Podhoretz. When asked in 1990 why he had stopped writing, Podhoretz lamented that he had lost his compass and no longer knew what to think, humorously noting that Crystal had moved all the way to Washington, just as, quote, the spirit blew out of the beltway, unquote. However, as Stephen Cohen argues below, the US-USSR Cold War never ended. Indeed, the consistent belligerent and bipartisan condescension of US foreign policy toward Russia since 1991 is indicative of deep-rooted and fundamental flaws that have plagued the US majority in the form of an aggressive arrogance that arises whenever financial, military, and political powers fall into the hands of a negative activist minority. I apply the term negative to signify the decidedly self-serving and willful use of violence in the process of manipulating the majority. Stephen Blank, professor and expert on Russia at the U.S. Army War College, states,
"The obvious implication of current policy is that NATO under U.S. leadership will become an international policeman and hegemon in the Trans-Caspian, and define the limits of Russian participation in the region's expected oil boom."
Immediately after 9/11, Vladimir Putin promised support for Bush's war on terror, with the caveat that NATO cease its eastward push. Bush agreed, and just as immediately, set about pushing NATO eastward. Professor Stephen Cohen of NYU points out that thus the Cold War never ended, and with the US today openly stating that Georgia and Ukraine are to become NATO partners, with US troops present, and with Putin having drawn the line with Ukraine, as Russia subsidizes much of Ukraine's economy, a new and very real tension has risen once again between the two largest possessors of nuclear arms. In fact, a US warship and 200 Marines were chased out of the Russian province of Crimea just weeks ago by a massive group of protesters. Implicit in the above is that the illusion or projection of Cold War triumphalism asserted under Clinton and Bush II administrations has lent additional leverage to those negative activists who are already seeking global supremacy and a new external threat in the wake of the Cold War, while Russians saw the end of the Cold War as an agreement between East and West. Negative activists in the US declared a triumph of freedom and democracy over a tyrannical regime. Moreover, for the average American, the valleys described by Alan Wolfe, the mid-1950s, the 1960s and early 1970s, and the Clinton years, seemed to offer hope. But a sustained increase in general prosperity, that a shift away from the spending of a national security state and towards domestic growth would have occasioned, never arrived. Such a shift would have required a sincere and sustained investment in the rise of an international justice system and the removal of US military forces from around the world. Persistent extremists in elite US foreign policy circles did all they could through these valleys to see that this would never happen. America was the only true force for good in the world, they argued, and had a duty to protect that force, with a heavy emphasis on force. The United States has shipped much of its infrastructural technology and economic wealth to Japan, South Korea, Germany, and elsewhere in exchange for its continued overseas military presence and expansion, some of it due to an obsession with roots in the racisms of the 19th century manifest destiny, all of it due to a determination to control the economic affairs of the world through intimidation rather than chart an equitable new course. To quote Bruce Cummings,
"Indeed, if there is one common thread running from 1945 to the present, it is the ever-widening sphere of American containment of an unruly world with no end in sight." Unquote.
Contrary to conventional wisdom, the Cold War with the Soviet Union was less about confrontation between two superpowers
and more about two superpowers ultimately exploiting the illusion of confrontation for domestic and global ventures of a profitable nature. For Soviet leaders, this illusion permitted the resolution and consolidation of its internal difficulties, most prominently rooted in its multiculturalism. Its borders grew more secure, and the suppression of dissent became easier. For the United States, exploiting the threat of Soviet communism in Europe fostered its wider economic command in European and global affairs. There were actually three Cold Wars, two of which are still raging, in East Asia and in Latin America. The United States found this threat convenient in both of these regions, lending an easy excuse for basing its troops in East Asia, which again goes back to America's historic obsession with China, and providing a distracting cover for long-standing exploits in Latin America, installing dictators to allow American fruit companies and other businesses to perpetually exploit the land while indigenous farmers suffer immensely. In fact, the best thing that ever happened to help cover the United States' imperial ambitions in Latin America was the rise of Fidel Castro, allowing the U.S. to point to the spread of communism and thus legitimize military operations, particularly under President Reagan, which in nearly every case targeted and killed the rise of national independence efforts, also known as democracy movements. As an undergraduate recipient of Oregon's most prestigious award for overseas study in Japan, and as a graduate with honors in Japanese history, I was shocked to learn only after creating my non-traditional independent master's degree program in peace studies how the transfer of power in Korea from Japanese to American hands in September 1945 held in place much of the divisive Japanese colonial structure and kept in power Koreans who had sided with the Japanese, thus alienating nearly all Koreans and serving to thwart attempts at reunified independence to allow occupation by U.S. forces to this day, a shameful trend repeated in Vietnam and countless locations throughout recent history. If we for a moment equate occupation with terrorism rather than the one-sided equating of anti-occupation movements with terrorism, another advantage of using terrorism is illustrated by Harvard professor Stephen Rose, director of the Olin Institute, a primary funding source for extremist think tanks. Quote,
"The maximum amount of force can and should be used as quickly as possible for psychological impact to demonstrate that the empire cannot be challenged with impunity. We are in the business of bringing down hostile governments and creating governments favorable to us. Imperial wars end, but imperial garrisons must be left in place for decades to ensure order and stability."
Unquote. To approach an understanding of the nature of U.S. foreign policy, it's useful to begin with an assessment of arguably the most crucial juncture in policymaking between the end of World War II and the present, a period spanning the mid-1970s to the early 1980s. Let's therefore back up to the subject of Midge Dector and husband Norman Podoretz, for the sake of highlighting once again their true objectives. Podoretz's End of the Cold War lament did not last long, and indeed, both he and his wife had apparently overlooked the solution to their need for a new external threat, which was present through a simple reorientation of a tactic laid out in the 1979 Jerusalem Conference on International Terrorism they had attended. This recount is best served with a brief discussion of the years leading up to 1979, most of which is common knowledge. In 1974, when Gerald Ford took over for Richard Nixon in the White House after Watergate, Chief of Staff Donald Rumsfeld insisted that Ford appoint Dick Cheney as assistant to the president. Ford had no idea who Cheney was, but under the pressure of Rumsfeld's insistence, Ford approved Cheney's appointment. The following year,
On November the 4th, 1975, Rumsfeld and Cheney executed the infamous Halloween Massacre, persuading Ford to severely reduce the powers of the pro-détente anti-Cold War Henry Kissinger, limit the role of Vice President Nelson Rockefeller, and most importantly, replace the proud Director of Central Intelligence, William Colby, with the extremely anti-détente and pro-Cold War oil man, George Bush Sr. Rumsfeld also bumped himself up to Secretary of Defense, and Cheney moved up to Rumsfeld's old position of White House Chief of Staff. This set the stage for devastating intelligence reforms and the eventual return of brutal policies in the CIA that had been drastically curtailed after Watergate, Vietnam, and other sins of statecraft. Each year, the CIA produces National Intelligence Estimates, NIE, and William Colby had staunchly defended their veracity in showing that the Soviet Union urgently sought parity through diplomacy, as it had all along, was in severe decline economically, and strongly desired an end to the Cold War. The NIE in 1976 showed precisely this, but the new DCI George Bush Sr. called for an independent team of outside analysts to challenge his CIA's own findings. Far from independent, each member of this group, called Team B, was closely tied to the defense industry, and all were extreme anti-Soviet, anti-détente, pro-Cold War hawks. Members included Paul Nitzer, who had authored the scariest documents throughout the Cold War, indeed had officially launched the Cold War with his NSC 68 while serving in the State Department as Director of Policy Planning, and Paul Wolfowitz, Nitzer's protégé, who has since produced the scariest post-Cold War documents. Dissenting views were allowed in the NIE in the form of footnotes, and the most prolific writer of dissenting footnotes in the NIE of 1976 was General George Keegan. Keegan had a history of creating pretexts, amongst them the Northwoods Plan, below, and the Death Ray Scare of the early 1970s, designed to build public and military opposition to détente. Keegan also had close ties, in the religious fundamentalist sense, with Jack Kemp, Gary Bauer, General Daniel O'Graham, and many other figures prominent in the rise of interventionist policy after Team B. Team B did not challenge any facts whatsoever, but simply embarrassed the youthful CIA team by alleging with great skill and flourish that the Soviets were building fantastical new weapons in preparation for a first strike. In any event, the outcome was that Bush used Team B's perspective to reform the entire basis for assessing Soviet capabilities, so that henceforth NIE were based not on facts, aka intelligence, but on imagined potential. The results, coupled with increasing pressure from a reincarnated CPD, forced the incoming President Carter to adopt a hard-line foreign policy, to the extent that by 1980 he was so strongly outgunned by pro-Cold War people within the intelligence community and the Pentagon, as well as within his own administration, that he announced in his State of the Union address precisely what had been put before him, rather than what he may have believed or desired. Chronologically digressing for a moment to provide useful background, among the previous sins of statecraft in U.S. history were Operation Northwoods and Operation Mongoose of 1962, two parts of one plan designed with help from both General Keegan and Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, General Lyman Lemnitzer. Northwoods was a plan to target American citizens in several cities and put the blame on Cuba, serving as a pretext for invasion of Cuba. President Kennedy rejected the plan, and some contend that this rejection led Keegan, Lemnitzer, E. Howard Hunt, and others to plot his assassination. In the declassified Northwoods documents, suggestions also include building a plane that looked like a Cuban MiG fighter jet to shoot down a chartered U.S. commercial plane filled with students flying over Cuba on their way to a Caribbean holiday. staging a military strike on the US base at Guantanamo, dressed as Cuban soldiers, and flying a remote-controlled commercial plane over Miami and using a fake Cuban MiG fighter to shoot it down in broad daylight for the American public to witness. I pause to mention this because pretexts such as these have been used throughout US history and represent the rising trend, from national to international, of organized assertions of combined powers of influence exercised in the hands of a negative activist minority upon the majority in the form of terrorism. First strikes on US assets have served as pretexts for almost every major war in which it was involved. Even in its struggle for independence from Britain, rebels in 1770 engineered a first strike against colonists, called the Boston Massacre, to galvanize public opinion and demonize an enemy. In extremely organized fashion, British soldiers were provoked into killing 5 colonists, a pivotal event leading to the War of Independence. Boston revolutionaries, under the leadership of Samuel Adams, portrayed the event as a cold-blooded slaughter of defensive colonists, revealing England as murderous and oppressive, and proof that there was no alternative to war. The findings of deep research into actual details of this event, as noted in Nafees Ahmed's The War on Truth, are both startling and instructive in understanding the efficiency of such methods. Widely praised as the best critique of the official inquiry into 9/11, the final chapter of The War on Truth illustrates America's legacy of arranging first strikes against itself to establish new external threats, to legitimize these threats in the minds of congressional leaders, and to galvanize public sentiment for war. Executive Director of Britain's Institute for Policy Research and Development, Ahmed highlights Professor John McMurtry's explanation of such events as follows. Shocking attacks on symbols of American power as a pretext for aggressive war is, in fact, an old and familiar pattern of the American corporate state, with an attendant corporate media frenzy focusing all public attention on the enemy to justify the next transnational mass murder. Throughout, there is one constant to this long record of hoodwinking the American public into bankrolling ever-rising military expenditures and periodic wars for corporate treasure, to provide the pretext and the public rage to launch wars of aggression against convenient and weaker enemies by which very major and many-levelled gains are achieved for the US corporate military complex. Ahmed's final chapter describes how such methods were systematically applied to the Mexican-American War and by the sinking of the Maine, which sparked the Spanish-American War, the sinking of the Lusitania, which ultimately brought the US into World War I, Pearl Harbor, with overwhelming evidence that the Japanese attack was deliberately provoked and allowed to occur to generate public support for entry into World War II, Operation Northwoods, the rejected plan to carry out acts of terrorism within U.S. cities designed to spark a war with Cuba, and the Gulf of Tonkin incident, an official lie that succeeded as a pretext for U.S. expansion of the Vietnam War. In this context, Ahmed points out, it's perfectly reasonable to consider the possibility that the 9/11 terrorist attacks were the outcome of the same sort of geostrategic thinking, rooted in long-standing political, social, and economic forms that gave rise to previous US operations along a similar framework. Now, back to 1979, the year that international terrorism found a new incarnation through consolidation of converging interests, and the War on Terror was conceived. Its conception was necessarily followed by a process of maturation, first applied to the Cold War, and in rhetoric with limited theatres, such as in Latin America and the Palestine-Israel situation, second in the post-Cold War formulation of a global War on Terror plan during the 1990s, and third in its implementation after 9/11. On January the 21st, 1979, 170 admirals and generals published a letter to President Carter in major U.S. newspapers calling for U.S. military superiority over the Soviet Union,
the recognition of Israel's strategic value, and the reinforcement of its military capabilities, and a final renunciation of détente. The organizers of this campaign were the previously mentioned General Lemnitzer, the Operation Northwood's Joint Chiefs of Staff chairman from the early 1960s, General Daniel O'Graham, a major Team B participant, and General Keegan, the second half of the Northwood's leftovers, and the main footnote man from the 1976 NIE. Around June of 1979, according to Zbigniew Brzezinski,
the United States launched a covert operation to bolster anti-communist guerrillas in Afghanistan at least 6 months before the 1979 Soviet invasion of that country. We did not push the Russians into invading, but we knowingly increased the probability that they would.
The U.S. had actively recruited Afghan warlords to form terrorist groups along the northern border, forcing the USSR to conduct a full-scale invasion in December to counter the U.S. destabilization program. Among the methods used by the U.S. in this program was the production and distribution of textbooks to schools, madrasas, promoting the war values of murder and fanaticism, fostering a generation steeped in violence.
The U.S. government, in collusion with Pakistan's leaders, took abusive advantage of the opportunity to rule out the creation of any responsible and independent organization among Afghans in complete disregard to the Afghan people's sovereignty and sacrifices.
In other words, the United States once again crushed a democratic uprising resulting from the occupation of Afghanistan by Soviet forces and allowing the U.S. to form its own resistance group against the occupation. This is where the Bin Laden family become deeply involved. The family helped fund the rebellion and enthusiastically supported Osama bin Laden's decision to join the struggle. Between July the 2nd and July the 5th, 1979, in Nafiz Ahmed's words from The War on Truth, citing Philip Powell's brilliant 1982 thesis on the organized reinvention of international terrorism,
a group of powerful elites from various countries gathered at an international conference in Jerusalem to promote and exploit the idea of international terrorism. The Jerusalem Conference on International Terrorism, or JCIT, established the ideological foundations for the War on Terror. JCIT's defining theme was that international terrorism constituted an organized political movement whose ultimate origin was in the Soviet Union. All terrorist groups were ultimately products of and could be traced back to this single source, which, according to the JCIT, provided financial, military, and logistical assistance to disparate terrorist movements around the globe. The mortal danger to Western security and democracy posed by the worldwide scope of this international terrorist movement required an appropriate worldwide anti-terrorism offensive consisting of the mutual coordination of Western military intelligence services.
The non-existent target of this anti-terrorist program leads us to ask what the real target was.
According to former State Department official Richard Barnett, the inflation of Soviet-sponsored international terrorism was useful precisely for demonizing threats to the prevailing U.S.-dominated capitalist economic system.
It's crucial to identify the architects of the JCIT's terrorism project. Thanks to Philip Paul, we know they were,
quote, present and former members of the Israeli and United States governments, New Right politicians, high-ranking former United States and Israeli intelligence officers, the anti-détente pro-Cold War group associated with the policies of Senator Henry M. Jackson, a group of neoconservative journalists and intellectuals, and reactionary British and French politicians and publicists. Unquote.
Among prominent individuals who participated were Menachem Begin, Benjamin Netanyahu, Shimon Peres, and George Bush Sr., the aforementioned anti-détente pro-Cold War group associated with the policies of Senator Henry Jackson, are well known to be Paul Wolfowitz, Richard Pearl, Elliot Abrams,
Douglas Faith,
Robert Kagan, Charles Horner, and James Woolsey, to name a few.
Importantly, Paul's thesis includes the entire list of the JCIT participants, many of them intimately connected to the 1976 Team B assault on national intelligence estimates and to CPD. Participants from the United States at this conference, arranged by Benjamin Netanyahu and George Bush Sr., were neoconservative organizers Norman Podoretz and his wife Midge Dechter, CPD, Senator John Danforth, Professor Joseph Bishop, General George Keegan of Team B, Ray Klein, former CIA deputy director who had assisted with Operation Northwoods and director of the Center for Strategic and International Studies, Jack Kemp of the CPD, Lane Kirkland, CPD's connection to the AFL-CIO, journalist George Will, nuclear physicist and staunch Cold War hawk Edward Teller, Richard Pipes of Team B and CPD, Bayard Rustin, CPD's connection to the A. Philip Randolph Institute, Professor Thomas Schelling, RAND, Ben Wattenberg, CPD, Claire Sterling, and Senator Henry Scoop Jackson. Participants also came from Britain, France, Italy, the Netherlands, West Germany, Canada, Ireland, and the largest contingency was comprised of Israeli military government and intelligence service personnel. The bulk of the international representatives not from Israel and the US were media propagandists long connected to covert operations. In 1981, some of the conference attendees published books, including Claire Sterling's The Terror Network and Benjamin Netanyahu's International Terrorism Challenge and Response, Proceedings of the Jerusalem Conference on International Terrorism, asserting the existence of this Soviet-backed threat. James Q. Wilson, writing in July 1981 in Commentary magazine, wrote, quote,
"For a decade or more, the United States government, like the governments of most Western powers, was largely silent on the question of Soviet complicity in international terrorism. Beginning in about 1979 and culminating in 1981 with the publication of Claire Sterling's book, The Terror Network, the evidence that the Soviet Union had provided substantial supplies and training to a broad spectrum of terrorist organizations became so compelling that it was difficult to deny it." Unquote.
In 1982, within just a few years of this conference, Philip Paul, the master's degree student at San Francisco State University, used his thesis to demonstrate that the JCIT's literature and source documentation was profoundly flawed, with authors often citing each other and altering official documents. Its assertion that there was a tenfold increase in international terrorism between 1968 and 1978 had been deliberately fabricated and contradicted CIA data showing a decline. And that's not the end of the article, but we've got to leave it there due to time. If you'd like to download this or any previous episode, you can do so from my MP3 archive at unwelcomeguests.net/archive. Our theme tune is by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. Now, thanks to Dave for the Zbigniew Brzezinski impressions. If you would like to contribute your voice to this show, you can join the mailing list by going to altruists.org/unwelcome, or you can email me directly, unwelcome@unwelcomeguests.net. And thanks to Unwelcome Guests listener and WikiSpooks editor, Urban, for helping with the article on the Jerusalem Conference on International Terror, the JCIT.